voters have decided who gets to govern in Congress.
The Fed decides today how much money to pump into the economy.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org for Wednesday, November 3rd.
Voters across the country handed the GOP control of the U.S. House of Representatives and with it political bragging rights for now. But as big a deal as it is, and it is truly a big deal, perhaps more important to the global economic landscape is what happens when the Federal Reserve decides today on how much money it pumps into the financial system. Scott Minard is CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Guggenheim Partners. He's with us from New York this morning. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What are we going to find out from the Fed today?
Well, the Fed is going to tell us exactly how many Treasury securities it's going to buy each month and how many months it expects to be purchasing those securities.
And what kind of reaction can we expect from whatever decision comes?
Well, the market has set an expectation that the program should probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion. If the program is deemed by the market to be too small, then we're likely to get a sell-off in equities and bonds. If the market perceives that the program is too big, then there will probably be problems for the dollar.
You say a sell-off of equity and bonds, so stocks are going to go down.
That's right.
And give us a little 101 of exactly what that means.
Well, what it means is this, that the economy is at stall speed. If the program to purchase treasuries and drive interest rates down to stimulate growth is deemed to be too small to be effective, then the markets will be disappointed with it. If it's deemed that the Fed is doing too much and buying too many securities, then the market will become concerned about inflation in the long term.
Hey, Scott, how sensitive is the Fed to politics and specifically what happened yesterday?
Well, the Fed definitely keeps its eyes on politics. The events of yesterday were fortunately well-timed. The meeting today follows the election. Given the mandate that was handed to the Republicans, the Fed is going to be very concerned about whether we're going to have gridlock or whether we're going to get any policy from the other side of the government to stimulate growth.
All right. Scott Minard from Guggenheim Partners with us from New York. Scott, thanks for the insight.
Thank you, Steve.
The midterm elections will have an immediate effect on the debate over whether to extend the Bush tax cuts, which expire at the end of the year. For more on that, we're joined by Mark Zandi. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics and was an economic advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Well, first on the tax cut issue, Bush tax cuts, as I said, are set to expire at the end of the year. Democrats had wanted to extend them for only those making under $250,000 a year. Republicans wanted to extend them for everyone. What happens with that debate now?
I think there'll be a compromise. I think in all likelihood, no one's taxes will rise in 2011, but those higher tax rates for upper-income individuals will be phased in beginning in 2012 and into 2013. So I think they'll find a middle ground.
All right. Now, the other thing is a lot of people that we've been speaking to over the last few days have been saying that a divided government is good for business, or at least business likes divided government because it means there won't be a whole lot of new regulations to deal with. What's your sense on that?
I think that's correct. There are pluses and minuses, and one of the big pluses is we'll get a bit of a policy timeout. No major economic policy decisions will be made, and that'll give businesses a chance to digest all the epic policy changes that have occurred over the past couple of years. You know, obviously healthcare reform and financial regulatory reform being at the top of the list. And until a lot of T's are crossed and I's dotted, I think businesses are going to be reluctant to go out and invest and hire. And this will give them a chance to get clarity and hopefully begin to hire more aggressively.
And quickly, Mark, the minuses?
Well, the key minus is if the economy starts going south, if we go back into recession, it's going to be very difficult for a divided government to come to some compromise to address that weakened economy.
Okay, Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's go straight to the source now. Congressman Joe Barton, he's the Republican from Texas who's in line to be the next chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. The committee deals with climate change, health care, and a number of other issues. He's with us this morning, the day after the midterms. Mr. Barton, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, on the issue of the Bush tax cuts, they're set to expire at the end of the year. Democrats had been talking about raising taxes on the highest income earners. Republicans want to keep the tax cuts for everyone. Now that your party is in the driver's seat in the House, do you think there's likely to be any compromise on this issue?
I think we're going to maintain the tax cuts. The question is whether Pelosi, Reid, and President Obama do it now, in other words, in the lame duck in the next couple of weeks, or whether we have to do it in January when we are sworn in to be the new majority in the House. But I think it will be done. What's been talked about is make the tax cuts for people under $250,000 permanent, and for those over $250,000, a 2-year extension. I think we ought to make them all permanent, and let's just do it and then look at cutting spending next year and bringing the budget back under control.
You are set to take the reins as the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee. What is your top priority on that committee?
Well, the first priority, and I spoke briefly with Leader Boehner, soon to be Speaker Boehner, and his chief of staff last night about this, it would be to move a repeal Obamacare bill through the committee and onto the floor. At the start of each Congress, the Speaker will have the first 10 to 15 bills with Bill number 1, Bill number 2, Bill number 3. I will advocate that Bill number 1 be repeal of Obamacare.
And do you think that that's realistic to repeal the health care law if you're going to have to get Democrats in the Senate and the president to go along with that?
The key on whether you can get it totally repealed is how many Democrats we can get to vote with us. And I think an open, transparent process that is fair, that the American people are a part of in terms of participation in the hearings and watching them on the internet and on television, then it's a doable deal. But you can't do it with just Republican votes, obviously.
What about climate change legislation? That would fall within your committee. Are we likely to see anything on that front, do you think, in the next 2 years?
Well, you're not going to see a cap and trade bill. That bill is not only an endangered species, it's extinct. I mean, it's gone. That debate was settled last night.
All right. Congressman Joe Barton of Texas, a Republican and soon to be chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
It wasn't just politicians on the ballot yesterday. There were a lot of ballot measures in states across the country. Voters registered their views on taxes and federal health care law and climate change. Marketplace's Scott Tong has some of the highlights.
California voters overwhelmingly chose to keep their state climate law. It requires 1/3 of energy in the future to come from renewable sources. In fact, many big oil companies actually prefer the law, says analyst Kevin Book at Clearview Energy Partners. Why? It caps emissions, but lets the industry decide on how to meet those caps, say buying pollution credits or selling cleaner natural gas into the market.
The irony of all of this is that cap and trade gives flexibility to big business by giving them a choice of when and how they're going to meet their reduction targets.
Supporters of the green law far outspent the opponents, which included two out-of-state oil refiners. On health care, Oklahoma and Arizona voters said yes to nullifying the federal law, the part requiring people to have insurance. It's not clear if that would fly in court. And in Washington state, Bill Gates Sr. supported a measure to tax the wealthiest residents. It went down. In fact, the company his son once ran, Microsoft, opposed the tax hike. In Washington, D.C., I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now that the campaign season is finally over, one thing is for sure. We'll get regular TV commercials back. Milwaukee Public Radio's Mitch Tyke reports on what happens on the tube now.
It turns out many ad buyers hate political commercials more than you do. That's because ads for other clients, shoe stores, car dealers, get bumped to make room for political spots. Local stations give priority to campaign ads, which pay more. Alicia Smits is an ad buyer for Laughlin Constable in Milwaukee. She represents clients like the department store chain The Boston Store. And she says there's an issue when the store has already bought time.
So the problem is, for the Boston store, our sales are really, really short.
She's talking about those special Columbus Day and Labor Day sales, which only last a few days and can't be aired later on.
When I get kicked out by politicians, I have nowhere to go because the other stations in the market can't take it because nobody has inventory for me to take. It's just not available.
That means lots of so-called make goods in the coming weeks, ads that were supposed to run in the campaign season but didn't.
Since they're getting pushed back, that puts more of a pressure on the station's inventory. So even though it's not as horrible, not nearly as horrible, it's still really tight.
Smith says that means ad buying will remain complicated even into December because ads for holiday sales will be competing for time with those make goods. In Milwaukee, I'm Mitch Teich for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update, November 3rd. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers section at marketplace.org. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects the United States.
As we told you earlier, all eyes on the global financial system are on the U.S. Federal Reserve. The Fed widely expected to announce today it's going to pump more money into the economy. Just how much, we don't know, but it will decide that today. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with the Marketplace angle to this story. Why the Fed move is so important and why it has global repercussions. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So why is everyone so interested in what the Fed's going
to
do?
Well, to see if the Fed resorts once again to the ultimate weapon in its armory, printing more money to buy longer-dated U.S. government bonds. The Fed will be hoping to drive down long-term interest rates in this way so people borrow to buy houses and cars and companies expand. Now, economic recovery remains fragile in Britain and throughout Europe too, so central banks here may well be tempted to follow the Fed's example, says Ian Shepherdson of High Frequency Economics.
It certainly puts pressure on the Bank of England, and I would guess that within the next few months they will indeed follow, especially if it's deemed to be successful in the States, if it holds down those long-term interest rates, which is what they'd be targeting.
All right, Stephen, he mentions the Bank of England. What about other countries?
Well, the European Central Bank, which represents the 16 Eurozone countries, has been much more cautious about printing money than the Brits or the US. But one of the effects of the Fed doing this, if it works, would be to lower the value of the US dollar against the euro. Now, that would make it even tougher for European exporters to sell goods and services to the States. So the ECB may then come under pressure to protect European exporters and to follow the Fed's example as well and print more euros.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
Today, 20,000 flight attendants with Delta Airlines are finishing the vote on whether to unionize. The merger of Delta and Northwest has brought Delta's non-union employees together with Northwest's mostly unionized workforce. Jim Burris has more from WABE in Atlanta.
Between the radio and TV commercials like this one from a major union,
all of us, we need those workers to keep their jobs. That's why
you'd think this union vote was really a national referendum. If the majority votes yes, this could be the first time in its 80-plus year history that people other than Delta executives determine wages and benefits.
We don't believe that the outcome of these representation elections would materially change our cost projections.
That's Delta spokeswoman Gina Laughlin. She says in the 2008 merger with Northwest, Delta already factored in what a unionized workforce would cost the airline's bottom line. Delta is hush-hush on those figures, but Laughlin says this issue isn't so much about cash.
This is about culture, not costs.
Laughlin says that the company already has an open-door policy where managers and workers have no trouble negotiating wages and benefits. Dan Petrie heads the business college at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Florida. He agrees corporate culture is important, but says unionizing Delta workers doesn't have to change that culture. That depends on Delta.
The onus is really on management to work tirelessly, to identify areas where they and their workers can agree and build a positive relationship, whether there's a union involved or not.
Petrie says wages don't play as big a role in the industry's bottom line as airplane capacity and, one more thing, customer satisfaction.
I think at the end of the day, what really matters is how do the workers interact with their customers, because that's what really builds your reputation.
So a merger that 2 years ago began with the question, which soda do we choose to serve, Coke or Pepsi, concludes with which status do workers choose, union or non? In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, November 3rd. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Go behind the kitchen door of some of the fanciest restaurants in America and you're likely to hear Spanish. For generations, Latinos have been the backbone of the food service industry. But there have been few Hispanic American top chefs. Well, that's about to change. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports.
49 and 34.
Lots of finer restaurants are closed on Mondays, but not La Gloria. This trendy Mexican restaurant overlooking the San Antonio Riverwalk is packed. Johnny Hernandez is the chef and owner.
Look at what's coming out the window. These are sopes.
A sopa is a thick corn tortilla, crispy on the outside, soft on the inside, and slathered with shredded meat and Mexican sauces. It's a Mexican street food that could be the next big thing in America.
It's a cuisine that is that's in its infancy here in the United States.
Hernandez is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. It was a long journey from growing up chopping onions at his family's cafeteria to owning his own place.
Yeah, Johnny has done it right.
David Kellaway is the director of the Institute's new San Antonio campus.
The way Johnny has pursued his path has undoubtedly given him a far more substantial tool bag to acquire his dreams.
But turning dreams into reality takes money. And for many, cooking school is too expensive. Not anymore. Billionaire Kit Goldsberry made a fortune off of Pace Picante sauce. He's giving the Institute $35 million, and that made the San Antonio campus and scholarships possible. He says it's time for Mexican cuisine to be as appreciated as the cuisines of Italy or France.
I started realizing that most of the kitchens in the country were staffed by Latinos, but you didn't see a lot of the chefs rising to the top of the great chefs that you hear about around the world.
And there's another magic ingredient that could help launch authentic Mexican food in the United States in a big way. Latinos now represent the second largest consumer market in America. Currently, one out of every six U.S. residents is Latino. That's 50 million people, and likely to mean longer lines at restaurants like La Gloria's. In San Antonio, I'm David Martin Davies for Marketplace.
Jeremy, McDonald's legendary boneless slab of ribs on a bun, the McRib, remember
Yummy.
The McRib? It is back.
All right.
Used to be Mickey D's would release the McRib sandwich to just select locations a few weeks out of the year, sort of like a bonus here and there. Well, now all the stores are selling it. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
Is it back?
That's what I heard when I said McRib at the office from Marketplace engineer Nathan Rule.
I have a childhood attachment to the McRib, but I need to go seek it out.
The McRib has been a kind of holy grail.
Sir, are you all right? I have eaten the ribs of God.
Homer Simpson once joined a band of ribheads to roam the land in search of one. McDonald's created the McRib in 1981. Sales were weak, so it became a sporadic special.
Pretty elusive, and it typically comes back in November based on what I see.
Alan Klein made an online McRib locator. How far has he driven to get one?
About 4 hours.
4 hours. Morningstar analyst R.J. Hodevy says McDonald's thinks the grassroots hype has reached critical mass.
The product has spread due to word of mouth, and I think it's probably long overdue to be a national product at this point.
But in 6 weeks, the McRib will disappear. Only the mystery will remain. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
And finally, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors has passed a law that bans restaurants from giving away toys with kids' meals that they deem to be unhealthy.
Now, the law says if you want to give away a toy, the meal it comes with can't have more than 600 calories, and it must contain fruits and vegetables. We did a little research, Jeremy, right?
Okay.
We talked about the McRib sandwich just a little while ago. 500 calories for the McRib sandwich all by itself.
So there you go. It falls in the threshold. They could get a McRib, and they can have a toy.
Yeah, but it's got, remember, fruits and vegetables. Unless a potato for the French fries would be a vegetable, but I don't know.
That's the tricky one. I don't know. Yeah, McDonald's, I'm not sure. I guess the kids in San Francisco, Steve, are going to just have to play with their food.
Oh, yeah.
All right, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis from Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.